Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2ManageVets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of The Bend. My name is Debbie Boone, and I am your host today. And today I'm so tickled to have Dr. Matt Soleil with me because we have been chasing each other for about 6 months now, trying to get this appointment set. He is such a busy guy, and he has a lot of bends in the road that we're going to talk about. So, Matt, thanks for being on, and I really appreciate us finally finding the time to have a chat.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Like two strangers meeting in the middle of the night, finally, right? It's looking forward to it.
That's it. Well, Matt even had to go, and we can all relate to this. He had to go and his cat escaped the house right before him call. So he had to go chase the cat and get it into the house first thing. But just to give you a little about Matt's experience and background, he is currently the president of the Veterinary Management Group's VMGs. But prior to that, and I guess currently you probably still are doing this, right? You're an adjunct professor of applied economics at U of F. And he is also, and this is where I met him, he was the chief economist, head of economics division for the AVMA. Prior to that, he worked for Elanco as the director of global and scientific affairs. And then this is kind of fun. He was the chief economist, director of economic and market research for the Florida Citrus Department. Now, a lot of economy there with the citrus in Florida, that's huge. And he is a UFF grad with a Doctor of Philosophy, Food and Resource Economics. So thanks for coming, Matt.
Yeah, super to be here. And the citrus job, that was fantastic. Lots of 100% Florida orange juice, grapefruit juice abounded. And if you love your citrus, it was a great time. It was a lot of good fun.
That's great. Well, you're my first economist on the bench. So I'm going to self-confess here that math is not my favorite thing. I've done a lot of math in my life because of managing hospitals and being a consultant, but communication is where I tend to drift more so than math. So tell us a little bit how you got started in your profession.
Yeah, how to get started as an economist, right? It all began in the womb with a dream I had. Like a lot of things, it happened through a combination of serendipity and maybe a bit of planning, although the planning part might give me a little bit too much credit to even say that. But I think my journey in economics really began with a college class I took in American economic history. And if you or some of your listeners hear that, and then they're vomiting on the inside, it does take a personality. But I've always enjoyed history for history's sake. And then it was history through the lens of economics and using economic principles and economic ideas to explain some of the decisions and outcomes throughout American history, both good and bad. And from there on, I was hooked because it was less about using math, which totally sympathized with that perspective that you shared, and rather focused more on the theory and the behavior of people and how people make decisions to explain the past, a little bit of the present, and also to predict the future. So kind of fell in love with the field at that point, and the rest is history there.
You know, that is fascinating. I love history, and I do believe vehemently that history will repeat itself particularly if you don't pay attention to it and understand what causes the history to happen in the first place. What are all the pieces of the puzzle? And we have to look back at that stuff in order to really figure out what's happening in today's world, because I guarantee you that there's been crisis like this multiple times in history, and people have managed to work their way through it, either well or not, but they work their way through it.
Yes, it's hard not to feel like we're in a terrible moment in our own individual history right now, and we very well may be, not to shortchange it. And yet, when you reflect on the last 200 plus years, just, you know, in our own country's history, there have been some really terrible, terrible things that we can't even imagine because we weren't there. And so the reminder there is we got through it. And we will get through it with what we're all going through right now as well.
Yeah, it's so true. So tell us about some bends in the road for you. How did life throw you a curveball? What have been some of your challenges?
Yeah. When is life not throwing a curveball? Doesn't it feel that way? Like, goodness, can you just give me a straight one for once? Like, please. It seems like it's just full of curveballs. They abound. You know, there's so many twists and turns here and could go in a lot of different directions. For me, it's probably a complicated story around parenting and who doesn't have that. For those who don't know me, I'm a father, husband of four kids. And, you know, the journey, I think that the challenge and the curveball, really the discovery process, was around COVID in 2020 when we were all in lockdown. And, you know, the end story here is discovering that my two oldest are neurodivergent. My oldest is autistic and my second ADHD, like 50,000 foot ADHD, right? Just like to the extreme. The energy is like, if you could bottle that up. But we didn't know that until just a couple of years ago. And it was years of a journey as a parent of struggling with their uniqueness and not knowing how to explain it. And having these, you know, these awful experiences as a parent, when you reflect on, you're like, oh gosh, did I do that? Did I say that? Like, what were you thinking? Do you not have a mind in your head, or what is wrong with you? Like these behaviors and these actions that didn't seem to have a rhyme or reason to them. And it wasn't until COVID, when we're all in lockdown and spending close quarters together for, you know, a long period of time, that we were really, my wife and I, thinking, you know, something's out of balance here. You know, we've been struggling, and yeah, parenting's always going to be hard, but this just seems like it's a little harder than it should be. And it wasn't just our relationships with them, you know, my two oldest boys, it was the relationships of the whole family unit that were being disruptive because of the neurodivergence that was unique to them. And so we finally decided to consult with a neuropsychologist and get testing done pretty close in range between my first and my oldest. And then, you know, the diagnosis came out, my oldest autistic and my second ADHD. And then it's, what do we do now, right? What's next, and how do we manage this information? I know you've got other questions that I can stop there, but that's been the huge, and we're still managing it. You know, it's an ever evolving learning process of how to adapt and cope.
Yeah, I can remember one of my friends said after she found out her child, who was probably in college, that he was ADHD, and she said, oh, I feel like a horrible mother because I didn't realize that all these behaviors that he was manifesting, I just thought he was being lazy or had lack of attention or whatever. But now, and then they put him on some medication, it completely changed his academic performance.
Yes,
because he could focus and concentrate for the first time. So, you know, it's good, if you think about it, that you had this opportunity and your kids are still young, to be able to find out now and then really help them flourish as they go forward, because there's a solution, right? There are tools that you can use. There are things that you now know that you didn't know before. I can remember, and I think about this often, one of my good friends was in elementary school with me, and you're talking about, you know, back in the 60s, and this child that was in my class could not stay in his seat. I'll never forget, my third grade teacher took his pants and thumbtacked him to his chair.
Oh, goodness.
And I said, oh my Lord, the teachers these days would have just, first of all, they would have had a heart attack, and so would the parents. But you know, there was nobody knew that stuff. Nobody knew, you know, any of that stuff. So you were just forced to sit there and thumbtacked him to his chair so we would quit jumping up and down and getting out of the chair and being disrupted to the class.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff, right? Yeah.
Right. And what we didn't realize then is that doesn't really truly fix the issue at hand, right? It does nothing. It may eliminate a symptom of what's happening there, but it doesn't do anything helpful for anybody at the end of the day, right?
It does not. It doesn't teach the child. It doesn't do any good whatsoever. And I think, you know, I look back at some of the stuff that Temple Grandin has done, and I think how wonderful the brilliance of the things that she's taught us, you know, in all kinds of aspects about being autistic, and the fact that you know, that still have so much to offer the community when it's focused in the right direction and people understand, you know, what's going on. But yeah, Temple's fun. We've had a couple of conversations together, and we talked about cows one day. So she has a definite opinion about cows and how they're supposed to be shaped, and it's not the way they're shaped right now, I can tell you.
Well, and what a remarkable individual she is, and what an enlightening perspective she's given all of us who have had an opportunity to just listen to her or read some of her writings, you know. And she's a good reminder, and you don't have to turn far to Hollywood and media to see all the stereotypes that are portrayed, right? And, you know, looking at autism as one of them, you know, you look at TV shows or movies that often portray them as these mathematical gurus or robots or these savants. And maybe some are, in fact, but it's an extreme stereotype. Like, I know my oldest son, Simon, he's 11 going on 12. He hates math. He hates it. Doesn't want anything to do with it. Right. And he's mastered the skill of average is okay. Like, I don't need to work really hard to excel in this because this doesn't matter to me. So, you know what? I'm fine getting a C in math because I don't really care about it. Right. But don't you give me a C in physical education because I'm a pro soccer. I'm going to be the next Ronaldo, right? So, yeah, he's got his priorities.
Really, you know, he has his priorities, and that, you know, that's all right. That's all right. When he is a pro soccer player, he will need math to count his money and make sure somebody is not stealing from him.
That's right. And we do encourage the backup plan in case he doesn't turn out to be the next Ronaldo either, right?
Yeah. Sometimes that bend in the road is, I was planning on being A and ended up being B. And there's certainly mine, because I was planning on being a veterinarian. And obviously I did not, but I'd just been on the periphery for a very long time, which actually worked out very well for me. Now let's talk about, you know, learning about your children. I mean, that's obviously, as a parent, it's got to be kind of scary, and thinking about how did you overcome that fear? Because it's not fear that I think that your kids are not going to thrive. I think it's fear that it's make the world harder, you know?
Yeah. Fear is a good word. Anxiety, just not knowing, you know, how can I do this? Like, how can I rise to the occasion and be successful here? Because everyone's human. Selfishly, you're thinking about, like, why did this happen to me? And now I've got to deal with this, as if parenting's not hard enough, right? I did not sign up for this. And then the guilt too, that I mentioned before, when you reflect and listen to the things that you've said around what is wrong with you, right? And then comes the deeper thought around, okay, my child needs something different from me. How can I be that pillar for him or her when I don't know what to do here? And then, you know, of course, there's the judgment of others who may know what's going on and have no tolerance for it, or have no idea of the challenges or the uniqueness of your child, but experience something that's disruptive and then peg you in a certain way, like you're a terrible parent and your kid's a terrible kid, right? So, and some people just don't have the patience for a conversation around, let me explain to you what's happening here. And so it is. And you know, the challenge of overcoming the fear of any sort, I think for me and my wife, comes down to, you know, removing two steps, removing uncertainty and taking action. That does so much across so many different things. So we, you know, informing ourselves through books, articles, talking to other parents of neurodivergent children, not just autism or ADHD, but Tourette's and everything else, to understand, you know, how they cope and manage. And then getting help, right? That's the taking action part of, like, you're not meant to do this alone. I'm not sure we're meant to do anything truly alone. Everything is a community, a family effort. And I mean family in a broad sense, right? Not just our brothers and sisters, but people we consider family. And so, yeah, working with a therapist to provide that support and be another voice, you know, and trying to fight those things of, you know, we found out when he was 10, okay, and Gideon, you know, he's 8 and he's 10 now. Why didn't we do this sooner? Like, we had our thoughts around something's not right here, but we didn't do anything. Why did we wait so long? But like you said, they're still young, and their life is a huge long journey. And so, you know, with it too, trying to give ourselves a little bit of credit. And the therapist helps too. It's not just the neuropsychologist isn't just to support, you know, Simon and Gideon and their journey. It's to help us in our journey too, around, you know, our thoughts and feelings as we process the challenges and moving forward in a way that brings us all to a place where we want to be in, which is just, you know, a family rooted in love and a mutual support.
And puns.
Oh, yeah. No shortage of those. Yeah.
But, you know, the thing that you said right there was, you know, there's guilt, but it because you don't know this stuff or you didn't recognize it, as soon as you think you should. But it's very similar to me coming into health practices as a consultant, or any specialist coming in to help, you know, maybe a general practitioner with some kind of specialty. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And you can't be blamed for that. You can't feel guilty about that, because everybody's an expert in their own way. And so obviously you and your wife are brilliant people, expert in...
One half is. I'm not sure about the other. That's an open...
but even then, no matter what, we only know what we know extremely well, what we spend our lives in. And it goes back to, you know, being very judgmental about other people, and humans default to judgment, right? That's just
what
there is, to find our biases. And we like to make very quick decisions so that we can move on to other things instead of spending a whole lot of time actually going, now let me really think about this, because this is where cultural biases come into play. We look at somebody, we make a decision, we move on. And it's in some way our brain's way of conserving energy, because otherwise we would have to contemplate every single action every single day and would be exhausted, you know, and almost incapable of moving through life if we did not make some snap judgments. But when we make snap judgments and they are based in cultural biases or things that actually harm other people, that's when we need to have that awareness and go, okay, now I really need to talk to myself and stop doing things. And so you just, you know, always give yourself grace for stuff, because you just can't know everything. You know, I would love to say
true.
Everything, but we can't know everything. You know?
No, and we shouldn't try either. You know, and the biases and what you just went through, you know, our brain lies to us in ways that we don't often recognize. You know, and this was a learning lesson for me. I was, I don't often have the opportunity to take my children to their therapy appointments, but I did this week. And Gideon's was talking about the most common brain lies. And what I learned this a couple of years ago, anxiety, dyslexia, they're a common co-diagnosis with ADHD, and he suffers through, deals, copes with both of those. And so common brain lies that we're managing with him are, you know, the disaster lies, like, there's a lightning storm, it's going to strike our house and it's going to explode. Or fears, brain lies around, well, I lost a game of soccer, so I must be a terrible sports person and I can't play sports ever because I lost this game. And so, you know, just learning those and ways to reflect on them and think about them and combat them, because they're not true, right? And you see this all over in our workplaces, in our own households, right? You know, things like, going back to ADHD, the labeling around, well, he's just a boy, little boys are rowdy, that's what the problem is. And we rationalize things in a way that allow our brain to accept it. And we have to fight that rationalization because it doesn't help anybody out. And we, you know, just use a workplace example outside of neurodivergence. You know, my boss is an angry person. He yells at me, but that's just who he is. I just have to deal with it, right? Like, no, you don't have to just deal with it. That's not the way it's supposed to be. So we've got to move past the lies that our brain tries to get us to believe and take a step back and ask ourselves the question, what is the right thing to do here? How do I manage this situation in a way that's helpful for everyone involved?
Well, you know, we were talking a little bit about the rants right before I started to record, and that again is something else that we've told ourselves that that's helpful. And in our brain, there's a huge emotional release, but the problem is we do train our brains to act in certain ways, and we gain emotional intelligence, or we don't. And when we don't learn to control our behaviors, control our brain, and it's just what you're talking about with your son. If he's got to learn to control that negative diatribe that's running through his head and see it for what it is. And when we are dealing with, you know, upset clients or upset fellow team members, often we'll go, oh, I can't possibly tell her the truth about how I feel about this because then she'll be mad at me, or I'll be scared, or none of that can really happen. And so we just bottle it up until the point where it blows up. And when it blows up, the person who is the subject of your anger is like, I had no idea. I did not, you know, and what is going on? And why are you mad at me? And what is happening here? Because you've completely blindsided them. But in your head, you've been running this little rat wheel of, this is every single thing that she does is showing me again that she doesn't like me, or she, you know, is trying to sandbag me, or she's trying to gaslight me, instead of just saying, maybe she's just busy, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah. So it's so, so important that those lies that I laughed and I told somebody earlier today on a call, I said, we just have to understand, and excuse my language, that your brain is a lying bitch. And she needs to stop. When you start to let it go, you need to go, I'm not letting you get away with that. And, and pull yourself back and start to work the problem. You know, that's the thing, is let's start to work the problem.
It's so true. And, you know, it's not easy, right? I mean, we talk about it and it's simple, but it's not easy, right? I mean, the simplicity comes in taking the time to self-reflect and try and identify what's happening and the lies that your brain is telling you. The complexity is taking that step back is a lot harder than you think it is, right? Because you've got to think in the moment to do that. And usually that moment is happening in an environment of stress, anxiety, duress, you know, something's happening and it's causing this spot judgment here that your brain is working to process quickly. And that's where the lies can emerge to help rationalize what's happening here. You know, and I think part of the lesson in this journey we've taken around one of the lies here that we rationalize intentionally or not is, you know, with all neurodivergence, I think there's something wrong with you. How do we fix it? Right. You know, and there are ways to support through medication, ADHD, for example. I think the reality is, though, is that there's nothing wrong. It's nothing needs to be cured here. It's a way that your brain is processing, whether it's autism, ADHD, Tourette's, it's the way your brain is processing and translating information into thought and actions. And it's not wrong, it's different. And so, yes, there are things that we can do to support you in this challenge and this journey that you have in this. And I have to be different here. I have to recognize that your brain functions different than mine. Not wrong, not better, but different. And so what do I need to do differently in order to better communicate with you in ways that are more effective? And certainly saying, what's wrong with you? Isn't one of them, right? I learned that one pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, you know, being in animal health for as long as I've been and being fear-free certified, one of the things I try to help animal people understand is we do this instinctively with our animals. And you were talking about your cat, who's Mr. Dart and Dash, who likes to the door. So, but your other animals are not like that. So how do we we prepare for those things? How do we manage the different animals? Because we do that, you know, we don't say there's anything wrong with this animal because it acts this way rather than this way, because that's, it's normal, right? So we just need to understand that humans do think differently, and that's nothing wrong with it. I myself have a little dyslexia, and I always say the best thing that ever happened to me in my life was a digital watch, because transpose the face of the clock.
Yeah.
And I have to look at it and look at it again. And that's why I could never go to a blackjack table, because I can't get it makes me so stressed to see that happening. But it is the way that my brain works. But yet I could do, you know, I can calculate a tip in my head in the heartbeat, because I was a waitress for a long time. But it's how we learn and how we do different things. But sometimes I see things very clearly that other people can't see, and are like, this is so obvious to me. Why can't you see it?
Yeah.
But that's just the way, you know, my brain works, as opposed to how some other people's brain works. But I think we need it all, right? I think we need it all, because that's how solutions happen, is to have people who think outside of the box, who think differently, who don't see things the way everybody else sees the way things go, because sometimes those things aren't going very well.
Right.
Somebody who is looking at it from a completely different perspective, and their mind is traveling a different path, to go, well, there's the gap, just like Temple Grandin.
That's right.
Right? There's,
yes.
Yeah.
Mind's traveling a different path, and it might not even be parallel. It could be completely perpendicular to your own. And that's part of the frustration here. And that just, you know, I think that transcends, you know, this conversation we're having on neurodivergence and this curveball that I experienced in just every aspect of our personal relationships with people. You know, I think we can all appreciate this. You know, I've often said texting is the worst form of communication, right? And my wife will send me a text, and, you know, then I'll follow up later and I'll ask a question, and she'll say, "Didn't you read the text?" I'm like, I read it, but I just processed it differently. Right. And so, you know, it's interesting that how our brains are different. And there's nothing better than when someone's processing at your wavelength, right? And you're in that zone together, and it's wonderful. And I think sometimes that can happen through chance and everything else. You just happen to be there together, whether it's a work meeting or, you know, a conversation with your spouse or whatever. More often than not, though, it takes effort to understand not just what the person's saying in a conversation, for example, but the thought and the emotion behind it, because then those are going to be some of the keys to help unlock that door to understand where they are and then how you get to be where they are.
Yeah. Because a person is the sum of their whole history. And, you know, I tell people all the time, because I have a class called Dealing with Crazy about conflict resolution. And the truth of the matter is that people might be angry in the moment, but they are bringing all their experience of the past to that moment. And even if it's not your fault, and a lot of times it's not, it's something that happened to them in their past. It's something that maybe another veterinarian or another business did to them. And you did something minor, but it's bringing all that back up. And very, very interesting how our past always affects our present.
Always.
Always.
Yeah.
There's a fascinating book, and if you keep saying what's wrong with you, there's a fascinating book that's written by Oprah Winfrey called What Happened to You.
Mm.
And rather than saying what's wrong with you, there, so many times it's what happened to you. And she said, I interviewed so many women who were in abusive relationships and their children. And she said, the women will say, well, I won't leave until the child is old enough to know what's going on. But she said, truthfully, the children, even as infants, knew, and they were affected by it later on, because there's such an emotional energy that happens in those negative situations that even people who can't yet speak feel it.
Yeah.
Because we are emotional creatures. It is about feelings for us. And we like to think that we're practical, but we are very impractical. And you're an economist, so you know that much of the sway of things in the economy has to do with how people feel about things.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you know, there's an and here, a really important and on what you just said around the importance of the past and predicting our decisions and the role of emotion. And if we look back on those experiences that are the most impactful in our lives, it's the emotion that we most remember, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've told this story before. I'm going to paint myself as a terrible parent here, but, you know, misplacing Gideon in Disney World, you know, a number of years ago, right? And there's so much about that experience that I remember. But what I remember most is the feeling my world is crumbling and I don't know how to fix it, right? Everything turned out okay. Yeah, he's with us. Yeah. But the feeling is there. And I think, you know, this is real. And this is what I love about economics too, beyond the models and the math, is it's around human behavior and understanding how humans interact with one another and make decisions. And how do we do that in a way that's better, make better decisions that affect us and those around us, right? Like you take the concept of a recession, for example, which is in the headlines, you know, a lot as of late and will continue to be. But there's a behavioral aspect of that, is that a recession could be a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways, right? The more you read about it and think that you are in one, you're going to behave like you are in one, and then we will be in one, right? Because the behavior fulfills the prophecy there. So it's very interesting, and it's not without challenges. But I think, again, the light here is that we own what we do, mm-hmm. and we own what we think and what we believe. Yeah. Things can inform us, things can influence us, but at the end of the day, no one can make us think, believe, or do anything other than ourselves. And so just, you know, remember that, because, you know, there's a lot of, I think, emotional and cognitive freedom that comes with recognizing that.
I'm reading a very interesting book, and it's The Language of Trust. And it talks about, since 2008, the Great Recession, prior to that, and you're certainly an expert, so maybe you feel the pain of this, but prior to 2008, persona of people in the United States was such that they believed experts. In fact, that's sort of how they got burnt in the 90s on the dot-com boom, because everybody was truly talking over their head about the internet. They thought, well, they must know what they're talking about. I'll go send you some money and invest.
Yeah.
But since 2008, there has been a skepticism that kicked in, because all of a sudden bankers could not be trusted to loan us money that we couldn't pay back, because, you know, bankers had always been the gatekeeper. If you can't get a bank loan, well, you can't buy it because you can't afford it. And now they were loaning people money who could not afford to do those things. And things happened there. So we became skeptics. So it said, you know, we were optimists, but optimists tend to be gullible. And then there are pessimists who, no matter what scientific proof you show to them, they still won't believe anything. So you really can't waste your breath on that. But the skeptics are actually fine if you communicate with them well, because they're going to listen and weigh both sides of it, and they're going to find what they believe to be the truth somewhere in the middle of that by weighing the information from both sides of the coin. And I think that's so valid in veterinary medicine, because we top down, you must do this kind of stuff in the past. And then we've got to realize that this is until we start to collaborate with people. And you've mentioned it again, this is a collaborative. Humans are built to work and thrive in community. And when we don't do that, I think this is one of the really big reasons that we're emotionally distressed from being locked down for a couple of years, is we lost our community and the people who kind of keep us on the rails. Because your friends will go, dude, that's weird. You need to straighten up, right? And we lost that. So tell me, as an economist, what do you think about the skepticism of people for expertise and even data?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, it's real. So you said that book was The Language of Trust. Is that right? This was right. I have it right here. Okay. I've got my top books that I've got there. You know, I first encountered Michael Maslansky a number of years ago. It was at during my career at Elanco, actually, and understanding how to talk to consumers about food and food choices. But it transcends that, obviously, because you mentioned the banking example there. And then we leveraged his insights at the 2020, I think it was the 2020 AVMA Economic Forum, and brought him in as a keynote speaker, because the language of trust is so applicable in so many areas. And the skepticism is real, so, so real. And what I've learned, this has been one of the most painful aspects as an economist, and it took me years to learn this, is that you can't lead with the data. You can't lead with the science. No, if someone is rooted in a position of disbelief or distrust in your position, no matter how much volume of data and facts that you throw at them, it will not change their minds. It will not change his or her position, because that position of distrust, disbelief, it's rooted in emotion. It's rooted in a belief. And when it's grounded in a belief, the data is not going to change that. So you've got to address the emotion. You have to address the belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fascinating book, and much of it. In fact, I probably was at the economic forum and listened to it.
Okay.
But it was so interesting to me, because I've talked a lot over the years about the emotion involved in a veterinary medical visit, and how it's all about connection with the humans. And if you want to really be successful as a doctor, then you first have to gain the trust of the human who's bringing the patient in. And it's the medicine is secondary, and that really hurts the heart of veterinarians, because they are medicine people. They want to fix the medical problems. But until we understand that humans are the decision makers, humans are the emotion behind the medicine, we can't fix the animals. We've got to be able to gain that trust where people go, yeah, I've been listening to you for a long time. I know that you won't steer me wrong. You, all of your team, not just the veterinarian, but the entire team builds that trust. And when that happens, it is glorious.
Yes.
It is glorious.
It is. And it's not easy to get there either. It requires a lot of hard work continuously over time. And it's not one that once you have that trust that then good, you can stop what you're doing and move on to the next thing, right? You constantly have to cultivate it like a garden. And I think, you know, one of the really powerful points in that book, you know, and going to your question around the data and the facts, to, you know, that's the adding element. And we all want to rush in with adding what we know, right? But the first thing we need to do actually is accept the person's position, accept the person's belief or their thought on a matter. Mm-hmm. And that's not even going to get you in the door. But it gives you an opportunity maybe to walk through the door of their mindset there. And we so often skip that. And sometimes it's visceral, right? Like the polarization that we are experiencing right now in our society, like, I can't accept you, right? I can't accept anything that you're saying right now. And that leaves no room for anything, right? There's no opportunity to come together in any meaningful way there when there is no mutual acceptance. And it has to start there. It always has to start there.
Yeah. When we start to make people other, you know, not humans, but we take them and we make them devils. Mm-hmm. And they're just humans like everybody else. You know, they have kids, they have jobs, they want the same thing for their families as everybody else does, but they just see how that should be accomplished in a different way. And until we start talking to each other, then we will not find a path forward. We just find two divergent paths that are going to lead us both into a hole, you know.
Right.
Neither of us want to be in that hole. You know, we want to be somewhere working towards better rather than worse. And you know, there's so many forces pushing us apart rather than pulling us together. And that's where we have to step in, I think, as a maybe a wise person and say, I'm going to make my own decisions. I'm going to row my own boat here. I'm not going to be influenced by, you know, whatever sensationalism is in the news for today, trying to get my eyes and my attention.
Right.
I'm going to look at the people that I walk into a store and talk to and say, these are the people. All humans are like this. You know, I kind of go through my life going, 99.9% of people are good. But we only hear about that 0.1%. There's some data for you, right?
That's right. And there are good people behaving badly, yes. Everywhere, right? And we don't fully maybe understand all the reasons why. And it's hard to accept that, right? Open-mindedness is a hard thing. And yet there's a balance here, right? Because as someone said, you don't want to be so open-minded that your brains fall out, right? So you know, what that means is, here's another quote that I love, you know, right is right, even when no one is right about it. Wrong is wrong, even if everyone is wrong about it. And so there are certain things that, you know, when it comes to, you know, criminal behavior and lack of morality, I mean, those things are off the table there. But it never ceases to surprise me around how visceral a debate could become on something like a provision of school lunches at schools, right? Everybody's like, surely this isn't something that should be so polarized, right? And so it's knowing where that line is, right? It's not easy.
Yeah. Same thing for the student loan forgiveness. And, you know, as an economist, I've heard many economists say this will put so much money back into the economy that it actually drives more revenue out there into the world. So we are, I think we're stuck in that. Like we buffered.
Is it you or me?
I don't know who it is. You're frozen.
Okay. You're coming through just fine.
Okay. You're coming back and forth, but let's see.
Okay.
We can always
see. My internet looks good.
Yeah. Maybe it was just a little blip in the cable company, but
okay.
Yeah, we'll just flip that out. Yeah.
All right.
Well, and you know, we could talk economics for a long time. And actually, for somebody who doesn't like math, I really do like economics. I do. I'm fascinated with like the big picture of things. You know, how all the parts of the puzzle come together and what makes things move the way they move, and even, you know, seemingly random outside forces that make changes, and we're like, whoa, you know, that's very strange. How that all played out. I think people were shocked, particularly like the war in Ukraine, as how that affected them, because they just didn't understand that all these we're a global country. I mean, all this economy is global. So what happens to our fellow countrymen in another country also affects us. You know, we're not isolated. We don't live in a vacuum.
We are not, and we haven't been for quite some time. And the globally connected economy and society that we are, you know, it is in some ways, it's not without pain points, right? Because we saw that through, you know, the war with Ukraine, in Ukraine, and the fabric of our food system being tested in ways that is quite frightening in some ways, in many ways, actually. And that's the hard part, to see when wrong is happening in other parts of the world, that affecting you and others around you in a wholly negative way. The silver lining in all of this is that when you are connected, what you do matters, and the positive aspects can have spillover. And when you're intertwined and you're interconnected, you're less likely to engage in conflict and in battle, because you depend on one another, and that dependence is very important. It's what binds a household and a family together. And you know, globally, it's the same perspective there. And some are very uncomfortable with that dependence, right? But just like you said earlier, you can't know everything. You can't count on yourself to do everything either. And that goes for individuals, that goes for countries as well. You know, we are on a planet with finite resources.
Yeah.
And so how do we share in those resources in a way that achieves balance for everybody?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to move forward a little bit and ask you, because you have had a brilliant career, what do you consider to be your biggest mistake in your career?
Well, that's kind of you to say. I don't know how brilliant I've been in that career, but maybe that's up for debate. Goodness, again, a lot of there's a deep pool to pull from on this one. Biggest mistake. I think in some ways I'm still a recovering academic. I spent a few of my early formative years in academia, and the training there is, because it's needed there, is to go deep on the details. And it was early outside of my career in academia that, I think I was still very much in that world. And I was, you brought up the position with the Florida Department of Citrus, and there's a governor-appointed commission that oversees everything. It's very political and bureaucratic. It's very interesting. But I was presenting data on the industry at this board meeting, and I threw my sweat and my blood into this presentation. And coming at, the industry data and trends from every individual angle, and I just thought it was brilliant. I did that presentation, and I saw the blank stares, and I thought to myself, I've wowed them. There's nothing else to say, right? But thankfully, I had a bit of a relationship with one of the commissioners, and he came to me after the meeting, and he asked if he could give feedback. And I'm in my late 20s. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but sure, And he said, you don't need to prove you're smart. Everyone knows you're smart. And I said, but that's not what I was doing. He's like, well, you also didn't give us any answers either. What we need to know is what we need to know. And there was a lot of information that you gave, but you never got to the point. And I was like, oh, okay. And so, I had many conversations with him and others around this concept of data and analysis and understanding what's happening through description of the trends. And really what you need to develop is a story around the end of that story being, what are the actions that that person listening to you needs to take? And what is the fewest number of data points that you need to tell them in order to convince them or persuade them to take that action? And not a data dump, right? That no one needs that, right? I'm not sure anyone ever needed that, but now more than ever, we don't need that. And that was, so that mistake where, I, as my mid older 20s, thinking I rose and shined and earned first place, I actually came in last. But it was a really great learning lesson that came with some really important feedback that got me learning and thinking about things in a completely new and different way.
Yeah, I love the storytelling because I guess I'm a girl from the South, and one of the things that we learn early on is to tell a good story. So my father was quite a storyteller, and a lot of people around me. But I've always valued a good story because it does move the needle. It more so than, here's a fact, and keep it simple. That's a really great point. You just keep it as simple as you possibly can. I remember many years ago, I used to tell my clients that a program was flea birth control. And one of my sales reps said, wait a minute, Debbie, that's not right. I went, no, I know, kinin inhibitor, egg tube, I know all that. My client doesn't care. They just need something relatable that says this is how it works and I won't have fleas. And so just really keep it as simple as possible and as clean as possible and move on with it. And so people can make an informed decision, but not be so overwhelmed that they feel it's too much to decide, right? There's been too much. They have to make too many choices. So just narrow it down to a couple of big points and then move right along.
Oh, totally. And that's how we're hardwired as humans, right? I mean, if you look at early human history and some of the earliest societies across the world, Mesopotamia, Babylon, the Aztecs, the Mayans, something that they all share in common was the use of stories to communicate ideas. No one around any of those civilizations was drawing bar charts or line charts to convince others of actions that needed to be taken, right? It was through the stories and the experiences. And as humans, we're still very much the same. Nothing's changed. Well, a lot has changed, but fundamentally about how we interpret and assimilate information, it's the story that's going to be the most compelling.
Yeah, that absolutely is. It absolutely is. Well, tell me about networking. I mean, obviously, you've gone from pharmaceutical company, I mean, citrus to pharma and pharma to academia, academia to association, association to DMG. Tell me what, yes. Are you recording? Yes.
I'm surprised one of my children hasn't come in. So yeah. Daddy, where are the Snickers bars? No, they're locked up, son.
Okay, all right. Lord, now he's made me lose my train of thought, man.
Networking. I think you were on networking.
Yes, tell me about how networking, I mean, how did that have a role to play in you moving through all these different positions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it matters, and networking matters a big deal, not just in our careers, but in other things that we do in our lives. I think gone are the days, and I'm not sure they ever were, that you can do everything and anything on your own. Not to sell ourselves short as individuals and our capabilities as individuals, but everything is complicated. Yes, individual achievement matters, but networking is like leveling up on your accomplishments, and it opens doors that you couldn't open on your own, or maybe even more importantly, I should say, not that you couldn't open up on your own, but never even knew that they existed. Right. And so it's important, and it's not, you know, it's not necessarily the schmoozing at industry meetings. I'm not sure that's what networking is. Maybe it is for some. I think networking is reaching out and building relationships with people inside and outside your sphere, your area, taking an honest interest in what they know and what you can learn from them. From their knowledge, yes, but even more importantly, I think their perspective and their lens of the world. And that's been, I think, the networking aspect for me that's been so important in this field that I work in veterinary medicine is the conversations with veterinarians, veterinary professionals, practice managers, every industry partners. They all see things a little differently, and they all have a different background. And to understand how to overcome, you know, challenges around, you know, workforce and well-being and other things, like, you need everyone's input on that. And you need lots of conversations to think about, how do we get through this together? And I think that when you position network like that around, not about how do I get ahead in my career and level up in my position, but more around, how do I get ahead of the trends and understanding what's happening and make decisions that level up everybody, then I think network becomes something more motivating.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I agree with that 100%. It's, you know, and it takes truly some of the pressure off of you.
Yes.
Then you don't have to know, you don't have to take a deep dive into everything. Oh, I know somebody who really knows a lot about that, so let me pull them into that conversation. And it is fascinating to have conversations with people who are looking at problem solving from so many different perspectives. And I've been doing some work with AHA and the Veterinary Visionaries and working with that well-being stuff. And it is fascinating because I, of course, see almost everything through the lens of how can we communicate better? Because when we do, then so many of the problems solve themselves. And then other people are looking at it through compassion fatigue, well-being stuff. Mm-hmm. Others, and I will say this too, physical well-being, because if you yes. are in pain, malnourished, you cannot perform well. You know,
no.
I really believe, I told AHA, I think that they should form well-being guidelines for the physical part of the job. It's done the mental part of the job. But physical part of the job has a lot to do with the fact that people just can't sustain the profession because they wear themselves out. Their joints and their bodies are worn out. And we have made improvements. I can say that in 1985, some of the products that we use probably would have killed us if we hadn't stopped using them.
Progress, right? Progress.
Gosh, you know, so many organophosphates out there, and we were just drenching dogs with them and not using gloves and so many bad things we were doing. But we did wise up about that. I want to get your perspective because you have just made a career decision, what, 6 months ago to move from AVMA to the BMG groups. Tell me how you make a decision that's, you know, really going to change your life and how you work so dramatically.
Yeah, making decisions is hard. It gets harder, even the small ones, right? Like, so I've become into birds, Debbie. It's like this new obsession I have. So I'm setting up bird feeders everywhere and reading about birdscaping. That's a thing where you landscape to attract the birds, right? And I was just, you know, on Amazon looking for a bird feeder, and goodness gracious, talk about decision fatigue right there. Like, I don't need to look at 10,000 different bird feeders. And if that wasn't enough, there's like reviews, and then that one negative review sends me off, and then there's suggested products and alternatives. And it's like, I just want a bird feeder. This is hard, right? And then you talk about complicated decisions around making a job change or changing careers in different industries, right? Like it's difficult. I think what's guided me is knowing what I'm after, knowing what you're after, and knowing what you're willing to get to give up to get that. And recognizing that there's always a trade-off. That's an economic fundamental. Like trade-offs exist everywhere, everywhere. And so understanding that. And I think, you know, the clarity is understanding a little bit around your end game. It doesn't mean you need to have this preconceived notion of what your life looks like. I guess guardrails around what you want it to look like, right? And does that next decision that you make in your career or your job take you closer to that? You know, and for me, it's always been this balance of choosing a role that has a positive impact and allows me to balance my commitment to my family. And two of those things just, you know, they're so important. The first one around just feeling like I'm doing something important and being a part of a greater cause. And the other is because I work to live. I don't live to work. And that's guided me in my decisions, I think, really well. And I think that construct is going to look different for different people around what is that for you? It takes some introspection. It's very hard.
It does. You know, I went to AVMA and I went to Cindy Courtney's lecture, and she was talking about giving feed forward. And I thought, this is really a great concept, because she said, I have a tendency per my staff in my 360 reviews to say, you know, she comes off as a know-it-all, and she's brilliant. She's such a bookaholic. She just knows everything. And she said, so this is my challenge. And I thought, so we were doing this little exercise, and so we were doing the feed forward exercise, and she says, okay, Debbie, how can I help my problem with being the know-it-all? And I said, well, first of all, having a conscious awareness of it, I said, but also engaging your curiosity instead of saying, I have to teach you stuff, always being curious about what the other person says. And so then it was my turn, right? So my turn is, I tend to overcommit myself because I am so interested in so many things. Yeah. And what you just said about the career decision really hit home, because what Cindy said to me was, when you look at these opportunities, are they what you want to spend your time with? Do they fall into that, this is important to me, your goals of what you want to do with your time and your business? And if not, then it's easy to make that decision to go, you know, that's fascinating, I would love to be involved in it, but it's not for me. It's not in my focus. It's not going to move my career forward or move me personally forward into something I'm really interested in doing. So I said, oh, that's really great, because maybe that will stop me from being like, oh, squirrel. Yeah.
And it's knowing where you don't want to be too. And that's just as important. You know, I had this experience a long time ago. I was applying for a strategy position in a big human pharma company. I thought that's what I wanted to do. I don't know what I was thinking. But anyway, I applied and I got pretty far, and then I didn't get the role. And I was I was so downtrodden, as most people might be, around, oh, I thought this is what I wanted, and I got so far and I didn't get it. And I actually was really insistent on feedback, and I got it, which was great. It was hard to hear. And the person who interviewed me said, you know, you really messed up on this one question. I asked you where you wanted to be in 5 years, and you were really wishy-washy and you didn't have a clear definition. And when we work in strategy, you need to have a clear articulation of what the future looks like. And then it was these emotions like, how dare you? Like, yeah, that's awful. And then you think, I'm an awful person. I'm so unskilled. How could I work in strategy? Because I didn't have that. And then I thought to myself, that's not what I want my life to look like. You know, he wanted me to say something like, in 5 years, I'm going to be the CEO of this division or something to that effect, you know, and that's not how I vision my life. I don't clearly, there are constructs and boundaries that guide me, but it's not so clearly measured that there's this one and only goal shot right there. And that's not right or wrong. It's going to be different for everyone, I think, around how you define what that future looks like. But always guide people to the principles. The principles, so you got rule books and principles. Rule books tell you step by step what you need to do and what the outcome looks like in an exact defined way. But the principles are like north, west, south, you know, and they'll get you where you want to be. Principles are easier to follow in some ways in the rule books because it's more general and there's an ability to be flexible in your thinking and your action. And it comes down to the situation or what do you need to guide you? Do you need the rule book or do you need the principles? And for me in my career, I needed the principles. That's what I needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of in the same position as that. It's just, you know, what fascinates me, what enlightens the passion about doing whatever that work is. And are there things that I can do? Yeah, there's a lot, I have a lot of skill sets that I can do, but what really makes me happy, and it actually makes me just want to kind of roll around in that work, you know, that it's just so fascinating to roll around in it. So Matt, tell us, I know one of your secret talents, and that is creating puns, because on LinkedIn there is a pun, and I have been involved in some of the punnery. But are there other secret talents that you have, something the listeners would be surprised to know about you?
Well, you know, a litany of useless facts. You know, like, I've learned you should always knock on the refrigerator door before opening it because there might be a salad dressing inside. You know, and I've learned as well that a hippo and a Zippo are not the same thing. A hippo is a little heavier while a Zippo is a little lighter. I'm not a smoker, but maybe you need to be a smoker to get that. I'm not too sure.
Of the puns that we see, these are dad joke level puns, right? Because they're all very very clean puns out there. I'm going to ask you for any final words of wisdom, and you know, we talked about a book we both pulled off the shelf. Any other books that you would recommend to our audience and say, this is something that you need to read and invest your time in?
Yeah. Oh gosh. There's so many. I think, you know, a book that I recently read that helped me personally was, it's called The 5 AM Club. And I am not a morning person. I have never been, I like to go to bed early and wake up late. Like, that's me, if I'm really honest, but I know I need to own my day, and getting a head start is really important, not just for my career, but being, you know, a husband and a father too. And so this was about putting forward the right behaviors to start your day at 5 a.m. in the morning to carve out the room that you need to prioritize the other things. And it's helped me a lot. And it's helped me balance, you know, work and life in a better way. And I think make better decisions for myself, just for my own personal health. I think just words of wisdom, you know, we've talked about, you know, curveballs and adversity. I would just end with what we touched on around, you know, take action and get help from others. Those two things will never go out of style. Ultimately that's why I'm where I am with veterinary management groups, because we are a community of practice owners coming together to help support one another and elevate everyone. And it's just a really wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah. I think working in a silo is never good. And I've been in communities where there were a lot of veterinarians who were very collaborative with each other. And that was kind of in the practice that I grew up with. We all knew each other. We borrowed stuff from each other. We talked about bad employees with each other. Don't hire this one. But then there were other communities that there was almost like a battle between practices. And I always thought, man, what a waste of energy. Really, just do what you do the best you can do and help people along the way. And you'll never go wrong with doing that.
No.
So thank you for taking the time and sharing your story with us. And, you know, I'm sure that there are people out there who can relate to your story with the kids and the career changes. And, you know, I people who can manage all that. I've never had any kids, and I think my life has been so simple compared to some of my friends who have kids and grandkids and all this stuff going on. So I really am impressed that you've managed to keep all the balls in the air, so to speak. And I wish you good luck with all of that. And I'm so glad that you found out your kids have these conditions so that you can work with them and they can, you know, flourish. And then you guys can just, who knows,
fly to the moon.
Amazing come out of this.
I appreciate all those kind words, and Debbie, and you know, I think you've made significant, many continued positive contributions on this profession. That's why I'm so thrilled that I know you and I've known you for a little while, because I know the work that you do and the impact that you have in each and every practice. And that just matters a great deal to me working in this profession, trying to make it a better place too, like you. And I know it matters to the people and the practices that you impact. So thank you for what you do. And thank you for being willing to have a conversation with me, because not many are.
They're just afraid. They're afraid of economy, right?
Yeah, I'm afraid I might put them to sleep before they're ready to go to bed.
Well, I knew better. See, I had conversations with you, so I already knew. All right. Well, thank you again. And thank you to the audience for listening. We will have all Matt's information in the show notes, so you can reach out to him. And if you're interested in VMG, I'm sure he will. We will have all that information in there for you too. So thank you again for contributing to the show and for all you've done for VetMed. And I look forward to seeing you again sometime, someplace on the conference trail, because I'm sure that's where it will be.
At a time and a place to be determined. Yeah. No, thanks, Debbie, so much.